back, WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are into the summer months around here and doing Baltimore Positive Conversation with my partner in crime, Don Moeller, former high school guidance counselor of mine. All of it brought to you by our friends at State Fair. We're going to get back over there for some more crab cakes, some chicken and waffles. I'm partial to the orange crushes, especially on these hot days and on the weekends. My wife likes a Bloody Mary over there. Go see our friends at State Fair at El Guapo. Don, they're opening a third location, correct? Another place that's going to have that famous Portale lamb shank thing he does, right?
And they're going to have the greatest cocktail on the plate on the face of the earth called the Catonsville Nine, and Mark will understand the significance of a cocktail called the Catonsville
What's in it?
Comes in it appropriately comes with bourbon with smoke coming out of it, Mark.
I love it.
It's feisty right out of the gate, just like we are. Our friends at Fadley shipping crab cakes all over the world as well. We're going to get back over to Fadley's. We began the crab cake tour at Fadley's with John Sarbanes. We're about to take the show on the road. Mark Steiner, I'm doing 30 crab cakes in 30 days in the state of Maryland. I sort of famously traveled all over the world and all these Super Bowls and all this stuff. I've never been to Deep Creek Lake. I've never been to Savage River.
Can you imagine? That's what I said, Mark.
I've never been to Point Lookout. I've never been to Oxford. I've only been to Tillman Island once in my life, and it was just to get
stuck at home.
No, I was in Tahiti. I was in Paris. I was in New York. I was chasing Super Bowls. I was doing stuff. So I was on the beach in Jamaica.
That. Nestor, when you were in high school, there was a bumper sticker that people proudly put on their cars over in Dundalk. And I love my Dundalk folks. It said, live, eat, shop, Dundalk. You took that to heart. You took it to heart.
I had one. But Mark, I'm doing this crab cake tour. So before we begin here, I need to know, where's your favorite part of the state of Maryland? Because I know you're a seasoned traveler here of all the back roads on the Eastern Shore, trying to turn them all into liberal Democrats, right?
What's my favorite part? I don't know. It's a hard thing to say. I mean, let me start here. Maybe people get pissed off, but
that's good. That's what we do on the show.
I hate Ocean City.
Okay.
I do not like Ocean City.
When's the last time you were in Ocean City?
I love Ocean City.
It's nothing. It's like Baltimore on the boardwalk or some shit. I don't like it. I'm sorry. It's just not my kind of thing.
Do you not like beaches, or do you not like people?
Oh, I love beaches. I love beaches. I go to Bethany.
It's just too crowded for you. I get that. Yeah, I don't like Miami for that reason. I agree with you.
I like space when I'm at the ocean.
I agree with that. Well, Assateague's right around the corner.
You just like hanging out on Hallengren's porch, having some cocktails, looking out over the pond.
And that's
that's all about.
That's happening in a couple of weeks.
What does this mean? Is he going to Deep Creek or something?
Hey, no. We have a mutual friend, and they go down there. And
where's the
just,
pond? You mentioned a pond.
Salt Pond in Bethany.
In Bethany.
Beautiful, beautiful
That's
pond.
Delaware. Who goes there?
Beautiful pond.
Oh, okay.
Beautiful pond in Bethany. We are with the president and executive producer, Center for the Emerging Media, one of the real icons in Baltimore media. When I always say when he speaks or posts or tweets, people pay attention. And
he's a Marylander. I'm upset with you, Steiner. I mean, I ask you to name your favorite Maryland place.
I don't have a favorite
place. You pee on Ocean City. You pick Delaware. But you did say Baltimore in the beginning.
Tell Nestor, here's my prediction. Yeah. I told him that his wife, Jen, the lovely Jennifer Aparicio, is going to fall in love with Deep Creek and that part of Western Maryland.
It's so beautiful. I love it up there.
I've seen the pictures now, and like I really want to go. I'm excited. I've never been about a trip like this.
When I was a little boy, every summer we went to Deep Creek Lake and we went to Ocean City.
Okay, so you did them both.
With my friend, with my dad's best friend, Charlie Stein. And we went back and forth, you know. But I mean, it was...
What was there to do at Deep Creek Lake then? It was like, this is the lake then, right? With cabins. Nothing touristy, right?
You swim, you canoe, you fish, you hang out. You know, you live in a cabin by the water. It's
you read. You just do the Walden Pond thing, right, Mark?
Yeah. Yeah.
Any bears involved or no? No bears?
Well, there are bears in Garrett County.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean... But there's so much about this state I love. I mean, you know, I like hanging in Annapolis. I think it's a great little town. I like Baltimore. I like Lookout.
Good answer.
You know, Point Lookout. I mean, I go down there. I have a dear friend who lives there, Wayne Carlin, a great writer, a professor down there. We have a Marine Corps vet from Vietnam. I hang out with him.
I have to have crab cake with at Point Lookout. See, that's what I need to do. I need friends of friends to show me the local terrain, you know? I'm trying to find Steny Hoyer to figure out where to go in Lexington Park. You know what I mean?
But, yeah, that's right. With Lexington Park's a trip, you know, because they have, from the era of segregation, they have two monuments to veterans. One's black, one's white. They're still over there in Leonardtown. But I mean, you know, I like it all. I mean, but if you want, you're not going to get a good crab cake. No, let me take it this way. The best crab cake I ever had is in my kitchen.
Okay. That's what everybody says.
My crab cake.
What's in your crab cake?
Is it a secret Steiner recipe?
It is a secret Steiner. And I'll be making it probably when I see Hallengren and the guys. I'll make my crab cakes.
Mark, when this is done, not only am I going to have that argument, who's got the best crab cake? Is it Fadley's or is it Costas? Everyone's going to have like, no, I got the recipe. My grandmother gave this to me
This is my recipe. No grandmother's, my recipe.
I'm going to say, let me just go out. I don't want you to give me the whole recipe, but okay. Tell me this part.
Yeah.
Is dry mustard part of the Steiner recipe?
Dry mustard is not.
Is not. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Okay. Right. That explains a lot about your crab.
Mark, if you had to go out,
yeah,
you've been all over the state, and not saying it's the best, but if you had one crab cake, not in the Steiner kitchen, you had some buddies come in, from out of state, and they said, Mark, take me to where I can get a really good crab cake. Where would you take them and say, I'm pretty daggone comfortable, we're going to get a really good crab?
You can tell we haven't asked him this question yet, right?
The first thing that pops in my head is Fadley's.
Of course.
That's the first place that pops in my head. It's just in the atmosphere of the place. You know, I mean.
I could have worn a shirt. See, I'll just put it up here. You know,
what's that? Is that a Fadley's shirt?
Yeah, I actually have a special background too that I can put myself at Fadley's anytime I want. It's sort of a state of mind thing that we do around here, you know. So,
but we love the folks, Bill and Nancy and Damie. And you're right. There we go at Fadley's. The atmosphere atmosphere can't be beat.
I'm here. I'm right at the bar.
Hey, do me a favor. Get me a crab cake and a beer.
I knew you'd want some oysters.
Mark, I hope some of that atmosphere is carried over to the new Fadley's, right? And to the new market. I mean, we don't want to lose all that authentic Baltimore.
I do love those folks who are doing it. The mannequins are great people. I really like them a lot. And Theo is a great guy. And his dad's a friend of mine. But I hope they don't play with it too much. I mean,
right.
I don't want them to Gucci it out.
Yeah, and I feel pretty good. You know, I feel real good about what the folks did at Cross Street. I don't know if you've been over, but I have not.
I've not checked it out.
Well, I think you'd appreciate it. I think they've taken it uptown, but they've kept the old funk to it. And I think it feels like Cross Street. And I think that's
I was literally there last night, Don, and I got this bittersweet chocolate mousse at the main produce market in the front. Oh man. Yeah. We're five blocks away. So I love the Cross Street. I love Lexington Market as well. So I'll feature it for the rest of this. Since you want to feature our Fadley's crab cake, we're okay with that, Mark. They're our sponsor. Right.
That was Baltimore. And we had those markets. There was that market. There was the market over on the east side. There was the
Holland's Ferry, right?
Holland's Market. Yeah.
On Pennsylvania Avenue, there was a market. I mean, markets everywhere. I mean, it was like, that's part of the soul of the city. I'd like to see that come back.
We're going to talk with you before this is over about the future of Baltimore, because I know you've been giving it a lot of thought and actually putting pen to paper.
But
before I do that, Mark, once again, as you always do, your history lesson over the past week to 2 weeks on an amazing Maryland woman named Gloria Richardson.
Oh, yes.
You wrote about Gloria Richardson on Facebook, and I thought, there's a book here or there's a movie here. That's when I immediately said to Nestor, we've got to get Mark on because I need him to talk and educate our listeners about this woman, Gloria Richardson. And in doing so, Mark, I'm going to get into what in the hell a 14-year-old boy is doing in Cambridge back in the 60s fighting for civil rights. But start with Gloria Richardson and who she was and why we should know her as Marylanders.
She passed away just this week at 99 in her sleep. And that was a just way for her to go. She was just this brilliant woman who led the civil rights movement in Cambridge, Maryland, to end segregation in Cambridge. She was from, she was born in Baltimore, but moved to Cambridge when she was young. And she let me just tell the story. It was really interesting. She actually, this is how smart she was. She started Howard University when she was 16 years old in 1942.
Wow.
And she started the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee. And she was just fearless. There's that famous picture of her where she's walking past the National Guard in 1963 and shoving the rifle with a bayonet aside as she walked. She was fearless. And people have to understand that Cambridge, Maryland is still a very southern city. You know, it's not.
Here's the shot, by the way. I want to share it for everybody that is watching.
And I believe the man behind her is the former mayor's father. He was also an amazing man. He drove us around when we were civil rights workers, and he used to keep he used to keep a 45 and a shotgun under his front seat. So while we were nonviolent in our demonstrations, in our response to the violence to us, everybody was armed. There was a day when we were chased through the streets. These two black guys and I, we were all our teenagers. And we ran to the Freedom House where Gloria had. And the mob stopped because on every floor and every window there was a shotgun. And when they came after us, the windows opened, the shotguns came out, and these white racists kind of backed up. We're backed up. So Gloria Richardson, she was brilliant. She was brave. She didn't suffer fools gladly. She built a movement in that city that was like no other that I experienced in my time in the civil rights movement, because she not only organized the working class, and her family was fairly well off in terms of the black community. If I remember right, I think her father was a pharmacist, if I remember right. Anyway, but she built a movement of the black citizens to stand up against segregation, face down the Klan, and armed white people. Students came from Goucher and Hopkins and Howard and Morgan to be part of these demonstrations. And we were part of a group called the Civic Interest Group, which was like Baltimore's arm of SNCC. And she was allied with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Action Coordinating Committee. And she just would not, and didn't suffer fools gladly. I mean, you know, she met with Robert Kennedy, and they did this, that, I think that she signed called the Treaty of Cambridge, which was, but she never, which was supposed to be a moratorium on demonstrations if the federal government would ensure the end of segregation in Cambridge. And they put it on a ballot, and she got all the black people to not vote. And so it was defeated because she knew it was BS. And she was fearless.
Well, Mark, what was happening? I love this. This oral history is just priceless.
Well, I'm going to be over at the Harriet Tubman, and we're talking a couple of miles away from there, right?
Right,
like,
right.
This is going to be a big part of what I'm doing in August.
Right in the heart of it. Exactly right. Mark, what was happening in Maryland? Because a lot of our listeners, they don't know that history. What was happening in Maryland and the 60s that brought Cambridge to the forefront? Give our listeners a sense of that history in Maryland. What was going on that she had to step up and do this?
Well, first of all, Maryland as a state was segregated. We were this weird hybrid of like a northern industrial state, you know, Bethlehem Steel and all the rest that was taking place at the Port of Baltimore. But it was a southern state, and it had to be occupied during the Civil War because of the southern sympathies. If you look at Federal Hill, those cannons on Federal Hill were facing down onto downtown Baltimore because that's where the federal troops were to keep Baltimore and Maryland from seceding from the Union. And so this was always had this state was a state with deep Confederate and southern sympathies. And it was a segregated state. So still is. It is in many ways. But in Baltimore, you know, we had the movement here, the civic interest group, and it was sit-ins and demonstrations to integrate, let's say, Reed's Drugstore. It was a big place we sat in all the time in Baltimore. The White Coffee Pot, where I got kicked through a glass door as a kid. And
that Reed's Drugstore was the one up on Howard Street, Mark?
On Howard Street.
Next to the Hippodrome, right?
Yes, exactly. The Hippodrome was segregated. Black folks couldn't go to the Hippodrome.
Right.
So Baltimore was a segregated city. And so that the movement started. But Cambridge was Maryland's Mississippi. I mean, it was a scary place. Everybody was armed. The black folks were armed. White folks were armed. There were shootouts between white and black people in Cambridge.
We're talking in the early 60s here?
Yeah. 1960, 1961, 2, 3, 4.
This is a part of Maryland history I don't know. You know, we talk so much about what the Republican agenda was a couple of weeks ago about, you know, what are we going to teach our children and stuff. I'm from Maryland. I didn't know a whole lot about Gloria Richardson.
No, listen.
I'm going to Cambridge, and I didn't know how segregated it was, to be honest with you.
It was highly segregated. I mean, even when – am I blocking her name? Oh, my God, this is embarrassing. The mayor of Cambridge, the first black mayor, woman. When I went to interview her and went down to interview folks who were part of that movement for a piece we did a bunch of years back on the Mark Steiner show, it was so fascinating to me that even though they had a black woman mayor, everyone else was white. It's still this bastion of white conservatism and right wing.
Victoria Jackson Stanley, is that correct? Yeah,
exactly. That's Victoria Jackson Stanley. Thank you. I just blocked on her name.
I have Google.
Oh, there
you go. Have age and wisdom.
Oh, yeah, the aging with a big A.
I gave you wisdom too. We're sponsored by Wise Markets.
Mark,
come on.
Mark, in the
it's
middle.
It's right here,
of
Mark. I got it right here. I got your wisdom. It's right here.
In the middle of this, and again, we're with Baltimore media icon and the president of the Center for Emerging Media, executive producer. Mark, in reliving the Gloria Richardson story,
yeah,
she spoke about you years later. She remembered some white Jewish kid from Baltimore. Tell us that. First of all, how does the white Jewish kid say to mom and dad, I'm going to Cambridge?
So what she said was, a friend of mine went to see her in New York, and brought my name came up somehow. I don't know how it came up, but she said, "Oh, I remember him, the little white boy from Baltimore," because I was like 14 years old.
Trying to imagine my grandson coming to me and say, "Hey, Pop, I'm going to go to Cambridge. I'm going to go down there and protest with a bunch of civil rights workers," and me saying, "All right, I'll see you in a week or two." I mean, walk me through this.
So it started with my mother. Mom was a Brit and met my dad in World War II. And she was an ambulance driver in Britain during the war and World War II. And so she hated racism. When she and my dad married, you know, she gave my father Richard Wright's Black Boy with an inscription for him to read it so he could understand his own country better. And so when I was not quite 14, so that would be in the spring of 1960, we were at Mondawmin Shopping Center. And we were looking over the balcony there to the ground floor. And there were a group of young black people picketing the White Coffee Pot. And I asked my mother if I could join the picket line. And my mother looked over at me and said, with her English accent, says, "Oh, that's a lovely idea. Sure. Let's go find the picket captain. We'll ask him." So we went downstairs and anyway, walked over to this guy. His name was Clarence Logan, Skip Logan, who was the leader of the civic interest group, which was Baltimore's activist civil rights group. And my mother asked him, and he said, "Sure." So I got a picket sign, and I started walking with him. And mom left. And after we finished picketing, I was so excited. I was like, I went to the store and I bought every black magazine I could find. You know, Sepia, Ebony, Jet.
Was that the moment for you, Mark? Was that the moment when it became real? When you write the Steiner memoirs, is that the moment where you said, I've got to do this?
Actually, for me, it started earlier because when I was 11, this is so strange telling you stories, but when I was 11, I was about to turn 11, my mother was having coffee in the kitchen with Mrs. Jackson, who was a domestic woman in our house, and her nephew, Mr. Dennis Foster, used to pick her up every day and take her home. And the three of them were having coffee and cake. And
tea, if you will.
No, my mother, it could have been tea. You never know. Yes. So I said, Mom, look, I'm going to be 11 next week. I got to be a Boy Scout. I got to join the Scouts. So I was just enamored with the Boy Scouts. And my English uncle had sent me the Lord Baden-Powell's original handbook, and I was so excited. And
did you tie a square knot?
Oh, yeah.
I still can't.
So Mr. Foster said, I'm a Scoutmaster. You can join my troop. And I have to understand. This was 1957. This was Baltimore, segregated. This is a black man speaking to me by joining his troop that happened to be on the east side of Baltimore on Ashland Avenue. And I said, and I looked at him, and my mother went, I never forget the look. She cocked her head to the side and she said, oh, that's a lovely idea. So that Monday morning, and that picture is posted on my Facebook page. That Monday morning, a Monday afternoon, he came and picked me up, and I joined his troop, and we drove from white Jewish Northwest Baltimore in Forest Park, down North Avenue, down Broadway, left on Ashland Avenue, right in front of the Faith Baptist Church. And so that was my introduction to the black world as an 11-year-old. And we were Boy Scouts there. I hung out in the neighborhood. And what happened was that we went to scout camp, Broad Creek, which was where everybody went with the troops when we were kids, and we camped out. We were the only black troop there. That's the picture. That's my scout troop. That's Mr. Foster I'm kneeling next to, Mr. Dennis Foster. This is my first day in the Boy Scouts. I'm 11 years old in that picture.
Great car, too. Yeah. Nice wheels.
Oh, that Mercury, man, that was a cool car. That Mercury was such a cool car. I love that car. So anyway, I'll make this quick. So at the camp, I was going down to get my Canoeing Merit Badge, and I walked past this other troop, and this guy was leaning over the fence, a scout maybe a year or two older than me, and he looked at me and said, where's your troop? And I pointed to where we were camped, and he said, what are you doing in a troop with all them N's? I won't say the word on the air. And I was like devastated. A Boy Scout would use that word. And my best friend in the troop was a guy named Edwin Johnson, who just passed away a little bit ago. And Edwin and I were camping buddies. And I remember the first day we camped out together, my mother packed two lamb chops for me. And his mother packed these two skinny-ass little SK hot dogs. And we pulled our stuff out of our packs, and we looked at each other, and we smiled, and we just went like this, and we shared our lunch. But then I would hang out at his house, and everybody in his community like embraced me as a little boy off of Ashland Avenue. But when he came to my house, nobody would play with us. And as a matter of fact, some of the guys in the neighborhood took umbrage at my bringing a black kid into the neighborhood, and they tied me to a tree over a red ant colony and left me there. And my mother came out with my sister, and they untied the ropes and stuff. But all that combined made me realize that what we call racism in today's world, in those days we just called it prejudice.
It's hatred. That's not a good enough word, right?
No.
Well, Mark, what I'm struck by, and that's what I love about these conversations, as you're going through that, I can see the streets. I can feel the community. I can feel the community where you're being embraced. I can feel the community where you're being repudiated and tied to a tree. And I'm thinking how
I'm trying to think if a black child would have come onto my block in 1975, whether our parents would have let us play with them or not. Like,
I literally, think they would
not. I grew up on an Archie Bunker block.
Probably would not have. And I'm thinking of the tragedy, Mark, and maybe you talk a little bit about this, about how, what a loss it will be if some of these conservative legislatures prevail with this idea of what can no longer be discussed and talked about in classrooms. I saw a list someone posted yesterday. It was absolutely terrifying. I mean, you're not allowed to talk about Jim Crow. You're not allowed to talk about slavery. You certainly would not be able to have Mark Steiner share this story about Boy Scouts and how it formed who he is. Talk about this strange, dark place that we're trying to dig out of, Mark, because I have real trouble making sense of it.
I mean, I think in some ways, I interviewed a woman yesterday who I really respect a great deal, Reverend Liz Theo Harris. She's co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. And she wrote this article called, "Are We on the Eve of the Third Reconstruction?" which was really an interesting article. And so when you think of our history, you know, we came out of the Civil War and Reconstruction started. And people like to blast Reconstruction as a horrible moment in our history, when in fact it was the greatest experiment in interracial democracy that we ever had at that point. And where poor blacks and whites, newly freed black folks and poor whites came together and built these democratic institutions, started public education in the South. I mean, it was an incredible moment, but the reaction was severe. And that's where the Ku Klux Klan started. And the former Confederates and moderate Republicans, they came together and to destroy Reconstruction, and they did, you know, and that led to and they completely wiped it out in 1877, and that led to 90 years of abject terror against black people in America, abject terror in the South especially. So, you know, so then fast forward, World War II, and you have returning black veterans coming back who refused to put up with racism and discrimination. And that was the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement that led to the Montgomery bus boycott in 55, the Supreme Court decision of 54 to end segregation in schools. And that gave us the Civil Rights Movement that begat the environmental movement, the anti-war movement, and all kinds of other things in this country, and created legislation like voting rights and the war on poverty and things like that. And the reaction for the conservative right was severe, starting with the Lewis Powell before he became a justice, and with the Powell memo organizing conservative opposition to all of this. And so there's been this like 50-year march by the right wing to consolidate power. And they have. That's exactly what they've done. And they've built this power. They control most of the state legislatures. They're passing anti-protest bills. They're passing bills to kill voting rights. I mean, we are once again on the verge of a major political struggle in this country.
Well, trying not to teach our children truth is also like
the critical race. They won't teach that.
They don't even know what that means. I mean,
no, they don't.
The silly part about that is that's just Frank Lutz tested that in a focus group. And it got a visceral reaction from white folks in a focus group. So McCarthy and the rest of them grab critical race theory because it gets certain emotional reaction. They don't. If you say to people, should you be teaching about slavery? And they go, of course you should. And they don't know. Nobody pays attention, Mark. This is the dangerous part. Nestor and I talk about it all the time. Nobody's paying close enough attention because people are tired and they just want to pay their bills and try to enjoy their so they're not focusing on the one thing that I point to, and you've alluded to it. Forget all the other, all the stuff is bad on the voter suppression stuff. I loved it when Stacey Abrams, Trump the Republicans, and they thought they were going to stop her in her tracks saying, well, we need voter ID. And she goes, I'll take the deal. Well, all of a sudden, there was no deal. I mean, she knew how to play it. I'm in. I'll take that deal. Because their goal in all of this, and what people are missing, is to put these little pieces of legislation in place that will allow state legislatures to overturn elections if they think the outcome is wrong. That's what people are. It's not all this other. The other stuff matters, whether you can get a glass of water or bag of chips, all that stuff. Yeah, it shouldn't be whether you can vote for 10 hours or 12 hours, whether early vote should be a week or two. It all matters. But what really matters, Mark, is saying to legislatures, yeah, we can overturn an election if we think it wasn't right.
And I think that this is going to call, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people about this recently, and I think there has to be a response on a number of levels. There's a legislative response. There's a political response. There are demonstrations. But I think what I've been saying to some people recently is we need to think about organizing something akin to the old civil rights movement. And when the 2022 comes up for elections, we need thousands of people. And I'm being literally serious about this. Thousands of people to go to the states that have passed these draconian laws, register people to vote, get them to the polls, and risk being arrested. It has to be confronted. You can't just let it happen.
Because so that was Larry Gibson's point. And I know you're fond of Larry.
Yeah, Larry's a good guy.
A long history with Larry. When we had Larry on, Larry was pretty clear about saying almost exactly what you're saying in terms of, we can't let this narrative take place. Folks, people have stood in line for 10 and 12 hours forever because of the franchise of the vote. That if we are steadfast, they can't win this one because we'll do whatever it takes. And what I hear in his voice and your voice is saying, it almost has to be the we shall overcome thing, right, Mark? Not to trivialize it, but we can't let this happen.
Yeah, we can't. I mean, we can't. I mean, we are, you know, I tell some of my friends who are on the left who want to just take it to an extreme on one side. I'm saying, look, we need a broad group of people in this country to say no.
Correct.
This cannot be allowed to happen. And I don't care if you're a moderate. I don't care if you're conservative. I don't care if you're a socialist. I don't care if you're a capitalist, left or right. We have to say no. This can't happen. We won't let it happen. I mean, we are literally in a battle for our future. And I say, you know, Don, you and I are fathers and we're grandfathers. I'm also a great-grandfather, which is really weird.
That sounds great.
So
Pappy.
But
come on, Pappy.
But I'm going to tell you just what I've been
doing. Oh, Pappy, belly up to the bar.
Give me a crab cake. We have to think about what world our children and grandchildren are going to inherit. We cannot let it happen. Our democracies are fragile beasts, and it could be taken away from us. And if we'd be fools to think it couldn't be taken away.
Mark, I'm a little blown away. And it's been a while since we got together. It's been so long that I didn't have the crab cake thing. So I guess it was last year.
Next time, bring me to Fadley's to do this, and we can have
believe me, this crab cake tour is never going to end. What I've learned here, and this is, I think I'm spilling the beans of the tour, is I'm going to be doing the tour forever because I don't think I'm ever going to run out of places to have a new crab cake here.
I love crab cakes.
Yeah, well, and they're all different. That's the beauty of the thing. Yeah. But it's been a little while since we had you on. The histrionics of all of this over the last 6 months now and 15 days since the insurrection took place, and now it didn't happen. They were tourists. Then they want to put, you know, Jim Jordan on the on the jury. It's
who, by the way, breaking news as we're recording this, Nancy Pelosi has vetoed that choice and another.
I bet so. Well, you don't want to let the witnesses to the crime who were part of the crime be, you know, involved in exonerating people. This last 6 months where Trump is in exile, raising money on every outrage. He's still a candidate in the eyes of some people. In the eyes of some people, he's going to prison. His billionaire buddy, you know, is taking payouts in the UAE. all the books are coming now, right? All the books of how crazy the shit was, right? That we all lived through and witnessed and knew he's sort of a drug addict, sort of out of his mind, psychotic, like all of those things we witnessed for 4 years. What happened at the Capitol on January 6th and the, I watched it. I've had witnesses on for 6 months. Now we're just going to pretend it didn't happen and no one's going to like get blamed for putting that together, that we're just going to give 8 months with the Republican judges and say, go make sure you can get out before it's time for you to vote the next time. We'll let you vote again. Like, I don't understand. The last 6 months has really been befuddling to me as to how wimpy the Democrats are once they get in power versus what we saw the last 4 years.
I mean, wimpy is an interesting word to use. I mean, I think that the Democrats have the leadership is not stepping up to the battle that we're facing. You know, I interviewed a woman named Anna Eskimani a few weeks ago. She is a member of the House in Florida, not the House of Representatives, in Florida State. And she's second generation Iranian American, working class woman, who represents Orange County, Florida, which has a huge portion of pro-Trump people in her district. And her response is really fascinating to me. I mean, interviewing and talked to a lot of state legislators around the country in these states. And a lot of them want to see, they see themselves as organizing that vote to come back over. Not to just, A, you have to confront it, but B, you can organize it to show the commonalities and bring people back over. I think both things have to happen. You know, and I think that we can't, and what we're facing, we cannot, I'll say it over and over again, we cannot underestimate the power. The right wing is organized both in a parliamentary sense and in a paramilitary sense. And we
but
have
also
to,
not based in reality in many cases.
What is that? But we all have different realities, though.
Right, exactly.
Right? And
clearly we do. That's the astonishing thing, because it never felt that way when Ronnie Reagan was running the country, that we had two completely different realities. You know, we had two different points of view.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I think we did that was one of the major turning points in America, was his presidency turning to the right. And rather than Democrats standing up and trying to build something, they ran to the right with Reagan. And I think that was a huge turning point. And Reagan played the race card all the time. He always used language that was attacking black people in America. I mean, he, you know, you can just watch, look at a whole arc of our history. I mean, there's a man named Rick Perlstein, who is an author and a writer, and he's written four really interesting books mapping out the rise of conservatism and the right from Nixon through Reagan to now. And I think that there's a real arc here. And I think Reagan was one of the most dangerous presidents we've ever had.
Well, people, I often point out, Mark, and like you, I understand, I do believe that there's true. Two things can be true.
Yeah.
It's one of my themes, right? There can be this affable Ronnie Reagan who has cocktails with Tip after six.
Right.
And they're amenable and they're nice. But then there's this other Reagan who truly did believe, and I would encourage people to go back and look at how he treated the protest in California when he was the governor of California. You come fast forward to when he's president and he gives that famous speech where government isn't the answer to the problem. Government is the problem. And then, of course, the massive tax cuts that I'm not sure the nation has recovered from to this
day.
From
an infrastructure standpoint,
he changed the arch.
Every time I hit a pothole, I think there's somebody with a country club thing that 50 years ago, they would have pulled $100 away from that rich person to fill the pothole. That's sort of the way the country got built. Now, the infrastructure part, I think, more than health, we had health insurance earlier, more than the price of the things that really fracture the country, taking all the money away makes everything worse. Everything worse. So that's the part for me that when I go to other countries and I see they've sort of kept up, when I go to Japan and see that, and I go to Germany, they kept up with their roads. Things are clean. Things are neat. We're in a different place here because billionaires are taking their money and getting in phallic looking things and flying to the moon instead of like doing things here.
Yeah, I'm not. It's funny you mentioned that thing to the moon, Mark. I don't know what your take was, and I want to get on to at least a preview of what you've been thinking about Baltimore. But I'm not opposed to exploration, and I'm not opposed to rich guys trying to be on the edge of science. But I said to Linda yesterday, I said, you know, I thought Bezos had a pretty good answer to this when he compared it to the Barnstormers and the Wright brothers. When
he's got a PR team like you and Kay.
Well, that was pretty good answer. That, you know, you flew 100 feet and the Wright brother landed in a cornfield. Who'd have thought that was going to be what it is? But I did say it's hard for me to look at what happened yesterday. I said to her, other than a much better, glitzier, more expensive version of Space Mountain at Disney World. In other words,
well, he doesn't pay taxes, Don. If I can go, issue.
Yeah. Well, that's a separate issue.
No, that's a big. That's not a separate. That is the issue
for
me.
It's a separate. Well, but it's a separate issue. But what I mean is, from whether or not the exploration is good. Do you have any thoughts, Mark, about the exploration itself? Whether it's worthwhile?
Well, I have a bunch of thoughts on this. I mean, I tweeted back and forth with Sherilyn Eiffel from LDF this morning about this.
Sure.
But I also posted this thing on my Facebook page. Let me start with this. I posted it just before we went on the air together today. There's a picture of his rocket going up, which looks like a giant penis. And underneath...
It looks more like a dildo, but I'll let you have it. It's fine. That's fine.
And underneath, there's a picture of two chimpanzees. One saying, they launched a giant dick into the sky today. And the other one says, his rocket looked like a penis too. So, but in seriousness, I think this is a dangerous precedent. I mean, here we are, you're talking about infrastructure. We're defunding NASA in all of our space exploration. We are taking government money away from that. And now we're seeing the corporatization of space, which I think is a real dangerous precedent long term, really dangerous for the country. This should be a public endeavor, not a private endeavor. It's about all of us. It's about our planet. It's about our nation. And I think that it is an issue that all three of these men are not paying taxes. But, you know, so... And I think people, you know, if they want to contribute something, take those hundreds of millions of dollars you're focusing on getting yourself to space, to the edge of space, and help rebuild our country.
First of all, I agree with that. The only place I would argue maybe with you and Nestor on the tax thing is, again, I'll go back to our elected officials. Fix the tax code. Yeah. Fix the tax. Stop talking about, in other words, none of them have been accused of doing anything illegal. They're using the tax code to their advantage. So I'd say
to the country's detriment.
Fix the tax code. So while we're on trying to fix things, Mark, and you've been gracious with your time, I know you're thinking deeply about Baltimore, and I'm not going to ask you to give us sort of a synopsis of your writings that are about to come, whether they're, you know, a lengthy essay or a book. But what are you thinking about? This is Baltimore Positive. What are you thinking about regarding Baltimore, Mark, and its future as you sit there now?
Well, first of all, the piece I'm writing, Don Mueller, you're going to be one of the people that gets it, because I want your response to it, given your history as county executive and more, and all the things you've done. But I've started writing this piece. It started out as a piece about responding to people who say abolish the police. And in fact, I just had a long conversation with my nephew, who's a cop in Seattle, about this. Because I think that rather than say abolish the police, we have to think, how do you restructure what we spend on public safety and where the
very different concepts, right? Two very different things, Mark.
Well, I mean, because if you go to the inner cities, most of the people in the inner cities, in poor communities of color especially, but in poor communities in general, are going to say, abolish what?
Right. Yeah, they want the police on their street.
I mean, because there are two sets of gangs for a lot of poor people. One's the police. The other, the thugs on the corner. And they're terrified of both. But let me not digress. What I'm saying is in the short term, you have to think about what you need to do to ameliorate the violence in our communities by investing more in rec centers, by having schools be 24/7 community institutions, by investing in mental health workers, violence interrupters, social workers who actually respond to most of the things that people are faced with, not just the police. Those are all short term. But the only way to end the violence in places like Baltimore, and using Baltimore as an example, is to think long term. To think, what do we do to put people to work? What stabilizes communities and creates families are people who have jobs that can take care of themselves. That's what changes the nature of a society.
And an education to get that job.
Yeah, you have to, absolutely. And so, yeah absolutely. You have to understand also that when you're talking about education in a place like Baltimore, in poor communities, you need more, you need to restructure it so it actually helps the child. You have to get smaller size classrooms. You have to have, I won't go into all that now, but this is a whole education piece that goes with this as well. But let me give you a couple of crazy ideas. So, A, that anytime the city spends money on anything, part of that has to be hiring people from inner city communities for those jobs. Whatever you do, that has to be part of it. B, two crazy ideas. One came from Wally Olinsky, and I pulled out.
Wasn't the birthday cake, was it, Mark?
No, not the birthday cake. But Wally, you know, was former president of city council and went to jail and all this stuff. But he was also a very brilliant guy. And he put together a proposal long ago about resurrecting the trolley car system. So we read it. And I started thinking, I'm looking at the map of where it used to go when we were kids, Don, where they used to go. You could go from Catonsville to Dundalk.
The number eight.
Right.
Exactly. Right?
So I think I started writing about how you restructure a 21st century version of the trolley system for metropolitan Baltimore. And it can be done. I've been talking to engineers, other people, how you would do, what would it cost? Well, you know, and so how you could reestablish that. It would cut down on traffic, but you can deal with that by parking lots and other things and having rebuilding a trolley system that goes across the city and puts people to work building it and maintaining it. Over the next 20 years, take a long time to structure. Other thing I thought about, and these are all crazy ideas for some people, but I think they really are doable. They're long term. I won't see the end of them. They'll probably be gone. But the vice dean of the School of Architecture at Morgan State University did this paper, and I've also pulled that back up and talked to him because I was just really thinking what a really interesting idea. Baltimore is a delta. We live on top of rivers that we've paved over. So, and Central Avenue, like winds its way from the northeast and down to the harbor, that's a river. So I modestly propose, let's unearth the rivers. Let's let them free. Let's build a city around these rivers. Let's put people to work doing that. Jones Falls, Central Avenue, start there. And recreate the city. And in that, it's putting people in the poorest communities to work, investing in education, and building a city for the future.
Is that what they did in like Medellin and different? I mean, there are.
Oh, yeah.
Medellin's
a great, yes, Medellin's a great example. They've done amazing stuff in Medellin in terms of they have a bus system now that's the best of the planet that gets people everywhere. You know, I mean, and they've just invested tons of money. I mean, you have to look around the world to see what other cities.
Well, you can see places that were far worse off than Baltimore, although, you know, we're getting there. That have improved, but they only improve with leadership. All the things we talk about here all the time at Baltimore Positive, literally, Mark.
I think that I think we had something way out of the box, as people say, and ideas that might seem crazy, but they're really workable. And think about how you build a future. And I think, you know, we've got, you know, the jury's out on Brandon. I like him. I hope he really does a good job. I'm behind him. I think Johnny O and Calvin Ball and Pittman are really progressive thinkers. This is a time for these men to come together and really think about how they build the metropolitan area. It's not Baltimore isolated. I mean, the port of Baltimore, between Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, and Baltimore City, they need to come together to really devise a new system to make this work.
Mark, you just touched on something. We just also had Stuart Pittman join us from Anne Arundel County.
He's a good guy.
One really effective young up-and-coming county executives. I think we're at a really unique time, and you allude to it, where we have a young mayor that has a lot of promise. You have these surrounded by these young, progressive thinking county executives like Stuart Pittman and Johnny O and Calvin Ball.
Governor's race is really important next year, huh?
Even if governor's race will make a big difference. And we'll have Mark back on soon to talk about that.
I'm sure we'll have Wes Moore on too, and Doug Gansler and Tom Perez.
Everybody.
Mark, we love visiting with you, man. I appreciate you always taking time.
I always enjoy talking to
the
two of you. I love it. I love talking to the two of you. This is always good.
I can't wait to read the piece, man, wherever it is. I can't wait to preview it. Nestor, this is what we're talking about. We talk about big ideas. And Mark, what you're doing there, and I'll give a shout out to Ron Cassie. Ron, 5 or 6 months ago, wrote an incredible article
Ron's great.
On how to fix Baltimore. It's guys like you and Ron at Baltimore Magazine who are thinking big. Let's get the smartest, brightest people in a room, and let's not sit around anymore. I mean, when you talk about opening up rivers, and I don't know if it's trolley cars or if it's electric buses, but let's move people around the city. Let's put people to work. This fun stuff, Nestor.
Appreciate you, Mark. As always, Mark Steiner, the man, the myth, the legend. You can follow him out on Facebook. Where do people follow you? What do I tell people if they want to catch up with Mark? Facebook?
Facebook, the Mark Steiner Show website. You know, we're putting new stuff up all the time. We have a weekly podcast now I'm doing.
You look younger than ever. I don't know how you do it, man. I don't know. You make me want to go shave and cut my hair, I'll be honest with you.
As we end this, I gotta tell you, I was talking about this the other day, and it's probably genetic. My dad didn't start turning really gray until he was in his 80s. I don't know why.
You're not 80 yet, are you?
No, I'm 5 years away.
And you're 75?
Yeah. And my grandfather never went bald. So I must have inherited those two sets of genes from my
there
head.
There you go.
That helps.
There you go.
And I'm 53, and I'm trying to keep the silver out of here, man. I'm trying to do all I can do.
I chalk it up to that North County living, too, now. So listen,
that's right.
enjoy the beach. Have some fun at Bethany with the boys. I know you guys will have some chuckles.
All right, I will.
I'll be here in Maryland, our home state. I'm not going across the border, although I am. They have a kangaroo petting farm, right? Very close to Bethany, by the way. So my wife and I are going to do that. We're going to be doing something. We're going to be ziplining. We're going to be seeing new things, telling stories, meeting new people. It's a Maryland Crab Cake Tour. All of it presented, of course, by our friends at Wise Markets and our friends at Royal Farms, where Chicken Palooza is alive and well this month and next month. I'll be hitting the Eastern Shore for some fried chicken as well. On behalf of former Baltimore County executive Don Moeller and our guest Mark Steiner, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore.